This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, May 16th, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums. Later on the program, our latest sampling of the interesting Arkansans profiled by the Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Today's subject, the late author E. Lynn Harris. And we'll find out how a musical tour of Fayetteville High School's halls became a YouTube sensation. We'll begin with another tour. This weekend, the second annual Trail Mix blended music, the outdoors, and environmental concern. Five bands were dotted along the Lake Fayetteville Trail as part of the six-week-long Artisphere Festival. Ozarks at Large's energy correspondent Christina Thomas went to Trail Mix, and she came back with this report.
Upon walking out to Lake Fayetteville's North Shore Park on this cloudy and cool day, one begins to hear the beat and rhythm of a band participating in this second annual event. Attendees are greeted by volunteers offering reusable water bottles, sporting the festival's logo, and a map marking the locations of the bands, which are spread out along the trail. Volunteer Jean Turiser says that she is participating because she loves the Walton Arts Center.
And I love being outdoors on an otherwise not so beautiful day. But it's just a lot of fun, and there's so many interesting things going on, and we get to hear this great plastic music.
Plastic Music is the first musical group approached as the journey along the trail begins. Plastic Music, both words spelled with a K rather than a C, uses all plastic instruments, such as buckets and tubes, and plays recognizable music from Beethoven to today's hip-hop hits.
I'm just got a few pieces of information about how the city of Fayetteville is working on various sustainability actions and some of their accomplishments over the last few years, and then have their plan that shows different things they're working on for the future as well.
That's Liz Hill, Energy Corps member with the City of Fayetteville's Sustainability Department. She had a table set up just beyond the first stage, passing out this information. Other groups, such as the Arkansas Energy Office and Ecological Communities, were represented as well. Activities for kids to participate in were also at this locale. Beth Ashbaugh, with Appleseeds Inc., offered such a project.
So we're doing some planting with the kids, making paper pots out of newspaper, and teaching people that you don't have to buy the little plastic pots when they're planting.
Attendees continue along the trail, either walking, biking, skating, or scooting, until they approach the next musical act. That's the music of Nielsen Mata and his group Brazilian Voyage. While originally from Brazil, the group now lives in New Jersey and made the trip to Fayetteville just for this festival. Mata says that he enjoys the green nature of the event.
You know, it's the natural thing, and it's very important always. Green is very important. We have to go for it. We don't have a choice now. At this point, any help is great. So this is perfect. You know, people come and see us play. You know, the electricity here is provided by the earth, the sun. So it's very, very comfortable to say I'm honored to be here.
As Mata mentioned, his set and equipment are powered by solar panels. All of the acts are fueled by an alternative power source. The next band approached uses humans, pedaling stationary bicycles. Dan Dean, Energy Corps member for the Walton Arts Center, was in charge of this particular setup, including getting the biker bar to its current location.
I've been organizing the biker bar and bicycle aspects of Trail Mix. A group of us met at Walton Arts Center parking lot this afternoon and rode up here pulling the biker bar to Trail Mix.
It took Dan and a dozen others about an hour, utilizing the city's Skull and Mud Creek trail systems, to make the voyage. While pedaling, he explains how the biker bar arrangement works.
We have three bicycles on trainer stands. They're turning an axle that creates DC power that's then inverted into AC power to supply power for the base amp.
The band that Dan and two other volunteers are powering is Hogtown Hot Club, playing gypsy jazz meets American swing. It is here where Mary Lopes and Claire Small had parked their bicycles and laid out a blanket, enjoying the tunes. They were appreciating the dancers, wearing colored elaborate masks and costumes, dressed as flowers, frogs, and insects.
And these kids are...
And I love the dancing. That's new. They didn't have that last year.
It's fantastic.
With those costumes, they're lovely.
And everybody's got their own personality that they're bringing out through the dance.
Yeah.
These girls are adorable.
Aren't they?
It's interesting to try to guess if they're girls or their age, right?
The dancers, located at each of the five stages, are part of Annie Hickman's Weaving the Wild. Annie's work blends together basketry, costumes, sculpture, movement, and nature. Local dancers and theater groups volunteered their performances, with a finale bringing all of the creatures together. At the final performance, guests either continue on the trail, sans music, or turn around and enjoy the acts a second time. Other groups involved in the event are Rosie Is Said and Papa Rap's Arkansas Salsa. Back at the beginning of the trail, or the end in some cases, audiences have walked or biked at least 4 miles. Volunteers say that they have passed out about 500 water bottles, but believe that attendance is more like 700. Trail Mix is a truly unique event, bringing together music and nature lovers, a true opportunity to enjoy artists that are inspired by nature, and in turn, are inspiring others. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
Ahead on Ozarks, we dip again into the catalog of interviews at the Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History to hear from E. Lynn Harris, a prolific and influential Arkansas writer. That's ahead on Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. As part of our occasional series on featured Arkansans, profiled by the Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History, Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich chooses the late writer E. Lynn Harris. The Pryor team videotaped Harris in the spring of 2006. He was interviewed by Jane Gerhardt.
Without realization, E. Lynn Harris crashed through a historic-cultural barrier with the publication of his first book, Invisible Life, the story of a Southern Black law student terrified by his sexual identity. Harris went on to write many more best-selling novels about the African-American gay experience, although it would take him years to come out of the closet himself. He did not refer to himself as a gay writer. Rather, Harris once said, the work was about how other people needed him to write such books. Even his recorded Pryor Center oral history makes little reference to sexual orientation. Everett Lynn Harris was born in 1957 in Flint, Michigan, but raised in Little Rock, along with three sisters.
My mother, one of the most wonderful women you ever want to meet, I think one of the things that I get from her that I'm most proud of is the fact that she's so humble and she's always taught us to treat people the way we wanted to be treated. And I've always seen her treat people that way, no matter who they were, no matter what their station in life was. Even people that she might have worked for, you know, as a domestic, she always seemed to treat people the same way.
Harris met his birth father only once. He died young. Of his stepfather, Harris wrote in his memoir, he was abusive, sensing his stepson's emerging sexual identity. He eventually left the family. Harris attended Hall High School in Little Rock, then a predominantly white school where he began to feel the pressure of being different.
We were poor, and I didn't like that. You know, I used to think that I was the only one in the household who knew we were poor. And the interesting part about it is that my mother and my grandmother, you know, worked for wealthy white families, and sometimes we got to tag along with them. And so, you know, I saw how other people were living, and I just didn't really think, you know, that that was fair. So I had a lot of angst, you know, growing up because I wanted, you know, more out of life. And it didn't seem as though, you know, people in my neighborhood or even my own sisters wanted that. So for me, that caused a whole lot of turmoil in my life.
The distinction turned Harris toward ambition. He worked part-time jobs, purchased nice clothes on layaway, but also got into trouble, was suspended from school for over a month. He turned himself around, though, after seeing how that embarrassed his mother. He joined the school newspaper as a sports writer. Harris loved sports and began to study journalism. He left school, but later enrolled at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville.
I remember getting on campus, and I remember just trying to find other black people, you know, because I had never been to Fayetteville the first time I showed up here. That day, I had never driven my car on the freeway. You know, I lived in Hodge Hall my first semester. And, you know, first semester was fun, but academically, I did horrible. You know, I did, you know, I had like a 1.3. And because I was partying, it was the first time I had really been on my own.
By second semester, he buckled down, joined Phi Eta Sigma, a National Honor Society for freshmen, and pledged Alpha Phi Alpha, a black fraternity. And Harris tried out for cheerleading, something he was interested in since grade school.
When I was at Arkansas, cheerleading was the last thing that the establishment were willing to give up. And by now, I'm a senior, so, you know, I'm editor of the yearbook. Everybody on campus knows me. And it seemed like they wanted someone who was very, very passive. I remember seeing one of the cheerleaders talk derogatory to one of the African-American girls during the clinic. And I went over and said, you can't talk to her that way. And so I guess they viewed me as a troublemaker. So anyway, they had three judges from out of town to come and judge from OU and Texas, and three judges from Arkansas. And so when the judging was over, it came out that I was the alternate and that this other black guy who was a freshman and very, very quiet had made it. And I was very disappointed because I knew I was the best. And so the next day, the campus was kind of rustling that I hadn't made it and that they thought something was fishy. And the dean of minority students got the scores, confiscated the scores. And they found out that the judges who were not from Arkansas had given me perfect scores on everything, and that the judges from Arkansas, the cheerleaders already on the squad, had given me zeros. So instead of getting two African-American cheerleaders, they ended up with four, which made matters even worse.
Despite dealing with remnants of institutional racism at the U of A, Harris continued to build a remarkable college persona. He was the first black cheerleader and black editor of the Razorback yearbook. In his junior year, a black recruiter with IBM met Harris, saw his potential, and offered him a summer job. He later joined the firm in Dallas as one of the first black salesmen. Hewlett-Packard, then AT&T, later recruited him, taking Harris to New York to work in the World Trade Center.
Making a very comfortable living, but I was miserable. And I went through a huge bout of depression. I was diagnosed as being depressed maybe when I was 26 years old and really didn't understand what that meant.
So miserable, he attempted suicide. But therapy finally helped Harris reckon with years of sexual and racial oppression, as well as childhood physical abuse. He also decided to pursue his dream of the writer's life. He relocated to Georgia, purchased a computer, and self-published his first book, Invisible Life, which he sold out of his car trunk.
And then I started getting calls from people in Philadelphia who said they had heard about the book and where could they get a copy and could I come to Philadelphia and they'd give me a book party. And, you know, in all different cities. And a lot of those times I went to those cities with my books where I would carry them, hoping I sold enough books to be able to get back to Atlanta. Well, one day in that little room that I was renting, I get this phone call from this lady and she said, someone gave me a copy of your book on Friday. And it was one of the most enjoyable weekends I've ever had reading. And I said, oh, that's really nice. And I could tell from her voice that she was white, and I thought, oh, this is great. And so she said, so what are you doing now? I said, well, I'm trying to sell these books. And so she says, well, if you're ever in New York, I would love to meet you. And I said, okay. I said, who do you work for? And she said, you know, I work for Doubleday. And I said, oh, okay. And I said, well, let me write your name down.
The woman was Martha Levin, then one of the most powerful women in publishing. Harrison put together a press packet, secured a New York agent, and prepared his pitch.
We go into the meeting. John gets there. We go into the meeting. And there's David Gernert, who was John Grisham's editor. and Martha Levin, and this editor who's supposed to be a really hot shot. Her name was Sally, I forgot. And the three of them were there, and John. And they were kind of looking at me, and you know, I'm looking at them. And so they said, well, you know, it's good seeing you, John. You know, what do we want to talk about? And so everybody was kind of, you know, looking around. And so I just got up and said, why don't I start the meeting? And I pulled out my little briefcase and the package that I had made at Kinko's the night before, and I just started telling them why they should buy my book. And they really seemed blown away. And when we left, John and I were standing on Fifth Avenue, and he said, you know, I've been an agent almost 25 years. And he said, I've never seen anything like that. And I said, what do you mean? He says, oh, you wowed them. And so while we're in the cab, he gets this call. And when he gets off the phone, he just says, Double Day just offered you a 3-book deal.
Double Day agreed to publish Invisible Life, one other novel, and a memoir. Harris was given $45,000 in advance. The year was 1987. He was 30 years old.
My mom didn't really understand a lot of this, but I think she was really, really impressed one day when I told her I saw Miss Onassis get on the elevator, because Jackie Onassis was an editor at Double Day when I first signed. And I used to, you know, always love going there, you know, hoping to get a glimpse of her.
At the time of this interview in 2006, Harris had published 9 novels, a memoir, and 2 anthologies. He had a home in Atlanta, another in Houston, and for a time, an apartment in Fayetteville. In the autumn of 2003, Harris returned to the U of A to teach creative writing in African American literature. One of the first things he noticed was cultural diversity.
I think back when I was a student here, it was just kind of, do we need to do it? Do we want to do it? I think from every person that I've met in administration, from Chancellor White to Dave Gerhardt, there is a desire to make this one of the finest universities in the country. And to be one of the finest universities in the country, you have to have diversity.
E. Lynn Harris said as a child, he dreamt of being a teacher, but was discouraged by a stepfather who referred to it as a sissy career. The distinguished alumnus, in the end, received the inaugural Silas Hunt Award.
I often tell the story of people ask me what's been the most special moment, you know, my career as a writer. And I said that it happened very early in my career, maybe on my 3rd novel. When I first started going out to the book signings, maybe I'd have 10, and then the crowd started growing to like 50, and then they started growing to like, you know, 100. Now I have, you know, it's not unusual for me to have 900 people show up at a book signing just to see me, and that amazes me. But on my 3rd book, I was in Houston, Texas, ironically, and I had like 150 people on a humid summer day, and I thought that was just great. And I was on a cloud that 150 people had come to buy my book and to meet me. And at the end of the book signing, when I was getting ready to, you know, go back to my hotel, because book tours are exhausting. And so y'all, hotel food and every day a different city. It was this family that was waiting. At the end, they had waited to be last. And there was a husband and a wife and a little boy who maybe was 9 or 10 years old. And his father came up, they came up, and he was standing in front of his father and his mother. And his father said, tell him. And he kind of dropped his head, and I said, I came from around the desk and got eye level with him, and I said, do you have something you want to tell me? And I was really afraid, I didn't know. And then his mom said, you know, she called his name. I don't remember the name. And she says, tell him. And he still, you know, was looking down. And so I said, you know, whatever you want to tell me, I'm here to listen. And he looked up at me with eyes I shall never forget. And he said, I want to be a writer.
3 years after this interview, E. Lynn Harris died unexpectedly at the age of 54 in Los Angeles from heart failure. He made the New York Times bestselling list 10 times in 15 years. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
E. Lynn Harris's first novel, Invisible Life, will be staged as a musical composed by Motown legends Ashford and Simpson and is scheduled to open in 2012. Today's featured interview comes from the archives of the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History at the University of Arkansas. For more information, pryorcenter.uark.edu. edu. Earlier today, we took a tour of Saturday's Trail Mix, part of the Artisphere Festival presented by Walton Art Center. The tentacles of that multidimensional festival, melding art and nature, reach all over Northwest Arkansas. Poetry Arm, called Poetivity, branched out to include a creative writing class at Fayetteville High School. Linda Brothers' class was asked to write poetry using nature as the third place as inspiration, beyond work, beyond school. All week on Ozarks, we'll hear poems written by members of that class, recorded inside their classroom last week. Today, senior Angel Rodriguez. His third place is a popular coffee shop.
An Arcega's afternoon. The bittersweet scent of a transparent drink. A soothing color. A soft breeze blows. So what are we doing? I don't know. As usual. The rustling of leaves catches my attention. The strong coffee smell fills my nostrils. People walk in, others walk out. Some in a hurry, some not so much. It's just a coffee shop, but here is where we chill. A car drives by, the exhaust nauseating. Friendly chat ensues on various topics, video games, movies, music. I take a sip of my drink. I pick the wrong one. This tea tastes awful.
Angel Rodriguez is about to graduate from Fayetteville High School. He says he plans to eventually earn his Ph.D. in supervillainry or political science. Tomorrow, another poem using the third choice theme. Sierra Eubanks, a current FHS junior, will read a poem about her favorite swimming hole in the Ozarks. And a bit more about Artisphere. It does seem to be truly everywhere this month. How about an evening picnic at a rose garden, complete with baskets of wine and cheese, an orchestra, and a fashion show? The Ozark Couture Spring 2011 Wearable Art Event is part of the ongoing Artisphere Festival. It's a brainchild of artist Leilani Law and designer Cynthia Parker. It's an event that will feature seven designers, each paired up with a writer or poet to inspire creative collaboration. Ozarks at Large's Ithi Agnihotri-Madolker spoke with designer Leslie Pinnell and poet Kat Fury to find out about how it's all going to come together.
In association with the Walton Arts Center's Artisphere Festival, Ozark Couture will present its second wearable art event on Friday, May 20th in Walton Arts Center's Rosin Memorial Rose Garden. The event will feature leading designers from the area paired up with a writer or poet to inspire creativity. I spoke with designer Leslie Pennell of ESC and poet Kat Fury to find out more about Ozark Couture and how the idea for pairing a writer with a designer came about.
I'm not completely certain because I'm Kat, by the way, and I kind of got pulled in on this at the last minute. I think it may have been the brainchild of Leilani Law a little bit. I know she's been working with like the Fayetteville Underground, who puts on First Thursdays, and I noticed that they're trying to pull more performance artists and spoken word artists into their art events lately, and so I would think it would be probably Leilani.
She's a big fan of collaboration.
Yeah, she loves to collaborate. So,
Ozark Couture was first hosted last fall by artist Leilani Law and designer Cynthia Parker. This year, the event theme is Nature as Muse. In April, a meeting was set up for the writers and designers to talk to each other and pair up.
Well, we had a meeting and all the poets were there and all the designers were there. And the designers presented pieces that they had made before and then pieces and elements of design that they're going to use for this one. And then the poets and the designers just sort of naturally came together and picked each other out.
As people talked about their projects and work they'd done previously, I think there was natural gravitation.
Yeah, which was what she was hoping for.
Apart from Leslie and Kat, the other participating designer-writer pairs are Brooke Benham, Clayton Scott, Kaylin Hudgens, Kate Brown, Cynthia Parker, Adam Douglas, Kata Mari, Julie Janine, Mark Hughes, Doug Shields, and Rosie Rose, Jenny Masullo. Since the first meet and greet, Leslie and Kat have met up a couple of times to discuss the details of their collaboration.
I showed her the types of fabrics that I'm using and the inspiration. The design theme for Ozark Couture is nature as muse. So I picked a jellyfish to be my design inspiration.
I believe what you told me that made you pick jellyfish was the notion of dangerous beauty, and then the sort of shape of a jellyfish and all the fringe and frills of their tendrils kind of suggesting wedding dress, and like the floatiness and sheerness of their body kind of suggesting some of those wedding dress fabrics. And so it's kind of this cyclical process. You know, where she shows me what she's got so far, and then I go and write more poetry, and then hopefully, fingers crossed, like maybe the poetry will like inspire ideas.
Participating designers are required to design 5 looks each. Since Leslie has chosen jellyfish as her inspiration in nature, she has a few looks in mind.
Well, I'm just doing sort of, I decided to use white because when I thought about jellyfish, I liked white, and then it being spring and summer, I wanted to make something sort of appropriate for the season. And then I've been inspired lately by working at the studio with Lindsay. She does a lot of wedding photography, so it kind of is all coming together like that. But I mean, I'm just using laces and sheer fabrics and veils, and it's not gonna be like the typical wedding dress by any stretch, I wouldn't think. Like, I'll probably be doing, you know, some minis or more casual wedding style. More just flouncy, pretty white dresses, I suppose.
Inspired by Leslie's concept of translating jellyfish into fashion-forward clothing, Kat has written a piece of work exclusively for Ozark Couture. Being a prolific writer, she's not new to writing custom poetry pieces. In fact, she enjoys the challenge.
Leslie actually challenging me, okay, you know, write about this and, you know, on this subject and work some of these ideas into it and take inspiration from these fabrics. And so I'm really excited about writing a whole new piece just for her work and to try to, I view my job here to be to, you know, basically listen to what Leslie's saying both in words and then what you're saying with your designs and try to like be your voice, basically try to translate in 5 minutes or less to the audience, you know, which is why I keep, you know, bringing her little poem snippets to show her and so she can veto anything that doesn't seem to be accurate.
Kat recites a few lines of the poem she wrote for the event.
What Leslie had explained to me was sort of the concept of jellyfish as deadly beauty or dangerous beauty. You know, not all of them are like deadly poisonous, but they all can sting and some of them can paralyze. And so, but they're also very beautiful, but then if you get too close, you can get stung too. Which of course, you know, I immediately thought about like, you know, the whole concept of the Belladonna and, you know, Lucrezia Borgia and all the beautiful women who are dangerous as well. So the little snippet that I've come up with so far was, there is no antidote for a Belladonna smile, the curve of lip, the twist of hip that makes allure ensnare. No rope can bind you tighter than a twist of braided hair. Her glance is clear as starlight, warm as milk, caresses like a lash of burning silk. A wedding bouquet beguiles with the kiss of anemone sting, euphoric anodyne. The direst, dearest bonds are those you do not wish to see untied. Her mood's mercurial as the shifting moon, reflected on the backs of windswept waves, soft as the twine and sway of wave-washed kelp, or complicated as a mermaid's locks, fierce and tangled as a lion's mane.
During the process of working together, the women have found they are more similar than different. Both are free thinkers and believe in the do-it-yourself philosophy. Their ideas of beauty are also somewhat similar.
Something about, you know, beauty does not necessarily have to be pleasant, which I think is why Leslie's idea of dangerous beauty really inspired me, because to me, beauty is whatever really strikes you and inspires you to sort of engage in a dialogue with it. Like, I remember seeing a picture of a ballerina stretching and you could see like all the tendons standing out. And then after you look at the picture, it's a painting. For a while, you notice that the tips of her toe shoes are stained with blood because she's been, and that ballerinas like do that. They practice enough to get blisters. And, you know, it was disturbing, but it was beautiful. It actually made me think about, you know, is this ballerina's effort worth the pain she goes through? And a lot of trying to make things look easier than they are. And
I guess like in people, I think confidence and security is very beautiful, just the realness and the beauty and imperfection of people, not necessarily their makeup's all in place or they're wearing a super expensive garment or whatever, but just the uniqueness of each individual.
The Ozark Couture Fashion Show, Nature as Muse, is part of Walton Arts Center's second annual Artist Fair, a six-week festival that celebrates art that helps people appreciate nature and sustainable living. The event starts at 6 p.m. Members of the Artist Fair Festival Orchestra will provide music for the event. Writers will be required to read their work while their partners' creations are being displayed by models.
We were told, just fill 5 minutes, a 3 to 5 minute piece, and just we'll have a, I think we were told we'd have a rehearsal where we could kind of practice, like a dress rehearsal, practice pacing the reading to, you know, how fast or how slow the models are going to be moving in and out in each of their different designs. I know each designer's doing 5 designs, and so I was definitely planning on coming up with a piece that maybe was a little flexible as to where its ending point was, as well, so that if the pacing, you know, something happens, someone, you know, breaks a heel on their shoe or something, we can stop it at a good point, or we can stall a little if we need to.
No, that's not gonna happen.
I don't think it'll happen. But.
The Ozark Couture Fashion Show is free and open to the public. It will be followed up with a trunk show at Studio Leilani, 112 West Center Street, Suite 220, on Saturday, May 21st, between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. More information about Ozark Couture is available on www.facebook.com/OzarkCouture and artosphere.festival.org. For Ozarks at Large, Amiti Agnihotri Mudholkar.
It is Monday, May 16th, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Bacon-Martin. She's the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
And, you know, we were just talking before we went on the air about how much the arts have exploded in Northwest Arkansas. It used to be there wasn't necessarily something to go do on a Monday evening.
Well, you would have graduations, high schools and university here, and things would slow down. It wouldn't die. They wouldn't stop. But that is anything but the case this year. I mean, since the snow melted, it has been full throttle.
Right. And this week we're going to have the debut of the Arkansas of the Artist Fair Festival Orchestra, the Arkansas New Play Festival at Theater Squared. Tonight we've got the Old City String Quartet in concert. It's part of Artist Fair. They're playing at 7 o'clock at Chapel on the Creeks in Rogers, and it's $5.
A wonderful venue.
And tomorrow, a little late, it's Earth Day at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks in Fayetteville.
Well, the Earth wasn't as kind to them as they wanted.
It's a little soggy, as I recall. This is special activities for area school children. So if you've got homeschoolers, or if you just like being involved with a whole bunch of kids, Shaw Elementary is leading this event, and it's from 9 to 5 tomorrow at the Botanical Garden. You can call 750-2620 to find out more.
Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
So, you think you know it all.
This young man here seems like he wants to show that the youth of America is not to be dismissed, ladies and gentlemen, or dissed. Maybe they don't have penmanship, but they got a lot going for them, right? How is your penmanship?
Like a drunk child.
There's a nice metaphor. See, he's using metaphors.
Chuckle along with me this week on Michael Feldman's What Do You Know? From PRI, Public Radio International.
What Do You Know with Michael Feldman, this and every Saturday morning beginning at 10 on KUAF 91.3 FM. Speaking of Saturday, the Metropolitan Opera season is now over. So, this Saturday, KUAF begins offering a few new programs. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me will return to its noon slot on Saturday. Then we'll offer Snap Judgment at 1 o'clock. It's been described as an audio roller coaster and compared to programs like This American Life. Then at 2, All Songs Considered, NPR's weekly music program. At 2:30 on Saturdays, Tales from the South, a program produced by KUAR in Little Rock that features the stories, music, and culture of the South. You can learn more about each of these programs and the new Saturday afternoon lineup at the website KUAF.com. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Christopher Spencer. He is the creator, editor, and publisher of Ozarks Unbound. Welcome back.
Three titles. Wow, thank you.
That's right. And also with us in the studio is Peggy James, and you are a teacher at Fayetteville High School.
Yes, I am.
You teach film and TV production?
We have two programs there. We have a film program and a television program. I teach television.
And I take it we can see your fingerprints on a video that has become sort of a viral sensation.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. We did a lip dub of Katy Perry's song Firework.
And if you haven't yet seen the video, it is worth a look. And I've got to ask, is it really one shot?
Yes, it's one shot.
Wow.
No edit at all.
And surely that wasn't the very first one shot. I mean, did it take more than one shot to get to the one shot?
Actually, no. The original plan was that we would get to the hallway. We had team leaders and zone leaders all over the school. Everybody had been given Excel files with extensive directions. They knew where to stand. They knew what their group had developed to be done. And when we first got to the hallway, we said, okay, we're just going to walk the hall and let you see what it looks to have us come through the hallways. And so we're going to run it all the way through. Then we're going to come back and we're going to run it once through with music so you can see how fast it takes us to get through the halls. And then the third time we're rolling tape, and we rolled tape, and it was a one-shot deal. From the time we dismissed students from class to do it and we were back in class, it was about 35 minutes.
It is this tour of Fayetteville High School, and it shows the extracurricular clubs and the activities that are involved. How many students are involved in this video?
There were about 900. That's our best guess.
And it's coordinating 900 students. Okay.
It's this meandering video.
Uh-huh.
You go all through the corridors, the labyrinth that is the current Fayetteville High School.
Mm-hmm.
And different students had different assignments when they would pick up their lip sync, their lip dub.
Right.
Performance.
And we take a kid who supposedly is starting the first day of his 10th grade year, and by the time we get to end, he has got his cap and gown on and he's handed a diploma and he walks into the gym for his last trip through Fayetteville
High. Well, and I have to say I found that interesting that there was sort of a narrative wrapped around it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, again, that this young man was starting school there, and then we hear the song, and that's sort of like him going through his experience
mm-hmm.
at Fayetteville High School, seeing all the different groups, for example, and then at the end he arrives, I guess, in the gym for graduation?
Right, yeah. I mean, as much as you can pull that off, yeah. And we actually, even next week, we'll have, it's tomorrow. It's called the Moving Up Ceremony, and we actually take the juniors and seniors to the gym, and we allow the seniors, as they're leaving high school for the last time, they walk through a tunnel of all their teachers, and then the juniors get to leave the junior side of the gym, mm-hmm. and they move up, and they get to go sit on the senior side of the gym. And so it's a little bit reflective of that.
Yeah,
it's the rite of passage thing that we do.
Was the song playing on the intercom system?
No, originally that was our plan because we thought we could all hear it. But then we had teachers who would call us and say, the intercom doesn't work in our hall. And so then we had to come up with another plan. And the cheer and palm, I guess it was the palm coach, has this thing called an audio vox. And so we just plugged in our iPod into the audio vox. And so it was sort of like just going through the halls with a big boom box.
Yeah.
And so we were blasting that music. And so the other halls could kind of hear us when we were coming, when we were getting closer. Plus zone leaders knew, they knew where they were in the song and they knew what lyrics were going to be sung in their hall, so everybody was just abreast. Okay, they'll be here in 10 seconds, they'll be here in 5 seconds, that we kept that kind of signal pass through the halls. But that's actually, I think it really helped us because the kids were probably a little more enthusiastic with loud music in the hall rather than if they had barely been able to hear it. And that's another thing, the students themselves had to be dead quiet. So while it looks like they're making all this ruckus and noise in the hall, it's sort of the silent scream. There's no sound at all in the halls, just the audio vox playing.
Was it always Katy Perry's Firework song? Or, and if so, why particularly that song?
Well, we knew we wanted to do a lip dub.
Mm-hmm.
And when we came back after Christmas, Magnolia High School in Texas had done Katy Perry's Firework.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Katrina Martin, who's the teacher at that high school. And I loved the song, but I knew the kids would just feel like we were copycatting her school. And so we spent probably 2 months trying to secure copyright permission from another source so that we wouldn't be copycatting her. But then, as it worked out, ASCAP, any other organization, we wrote to the artists themselves, to their companies, nobody responded. It wasn't like, no, you can't. It was just like silence. So when it came down to it, we had copyright permission for 2 songs because I belong to an organization that provides music to high schools, and it happened that Firework was one of them. We played with the 2 songs, but we really just loved the sentiment that was in Firework. And we just said, you know, we have to do it now. This is what we're going to roll with. It's great. It's going to work. And in the end, I really believe it was the best choice because the kids knew that song so well, and it was so easy to sing along with. I think if we had chosen a song that was unfamiliar to them, it just wouldn't have flown as well as it did.
What was the response you got from the administration when you kind of, I guess, went in front of them and said, can I do this thing?
We have a new principal this year, and I was a little unsure about, you know, whether he would go for something like this that would be a little bit out there. But he was like, when I walked into his office, oh, yeah, I've seen one of those before. That's fine. That'll be great. So it was a no-brainer. Now, had I had all the administrators in there who hadn't seen it, you know, it's a really hard concept. And I'm going to get 900 kids, and I'm going to put them in the hall, and we're going to sing a song. It's a real stretch for the imagination. But he embraced it, and that really helped.
It seems to me that it's, I mean, almost kind of something you would point to as an administrator. Look at what this school has produced, mm-hmm. or maybe a recruiting tool of sorts. I don't know. But what do you think is the goal or the end result now?
Well, from seeing other schools do it, mm-hmm. I knew that the mood in the schools seemed to drastically change after they did a lip dub. It was groups cheering for groups, unlike in a pep rally that's pretty predictable. Oh, we're cheering for that group of girls or boys that play a sport, and we have the cheer and the palm squad that cheer for them. And so we're always cheering for those groups, and I support that 100%. But this time it is, I'm in the Rubik's Cube Club. I'm in the choir. I'm on the yearbook staff. And all 900 of those kids that were out there were yelling and screaming for their club. So I knew that was going to be a result. I don't think they knew it was going to be a result. It was pretty funny in the gym when it was over. The kids were just ecstatic, and they just kept cheering and cheering. And the principal came up to me, and we did the little fist bump, and we were like, yes, it worked. And then he said, but we don't have a plan for how to end this thing, do we?
And, no exit strategy.
Yeah, we had absolutely no exit strategy. And so we were like, how do we get them back to class, you know? And you know, finally we were just like going fourth period. And they did. But it really was a mood changer for our school. We have just finished end of course exams. We've just finished AP testing. Our seniors had, well, not just our seniors, but our school prom was on Saturday night. It was just a real release of all the tension. I think anybody probably would have thought it was the lousiest day I could have chosen to do it. But in hindsight, it was probably the best day because it was just a great pressure release. Everything just worked.
Peggy James teaches television at Fayetteville High School, and she helped direct the lip-dub Fayetteville High School version of Firework by Katy Perry. She talked with Christopher Spencer and myself last week inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. And that conversation was a regular feature of our collaboration at Ozarks at Large with Ozarks Unbound. Christopher Spencer is the editor and publisher of OzarksUnbound.com. This is Ozarks at Large.
Do you ever feel like a plastic bag drifting through the wind, wanting to start again? So paper thin, like a house of cards, one blow from caving in. Do you ever
This is Ozarks at Large. Sean Philip Mabry, a familiar face to many who attend theater in Northwest Arkansas, died early Sunday morning. He lit up whatever stage he was on. He was in performances at the University of Arkansas with Theater Squared and recently with the Artist Laboratory Theater. This morning, when reviewing a recording Sean made with fellow cast members of Theater Squared's Every Christmas Story Ever Told and Then Some from last December, it was easy to see why audiences and fellow actors were drawn to him. His infectious laugh can be heard throughout the discussion the cast and crew taped in advance of the production back in December. And when he was acting for a small group at the Fayetteville Public Library that night, his passion for acting was evident. Our thoughts to Sean's family, friends, and colleagues. That's just about all the time we have for this edition of Ozarks at Large. Local support for Ozarks at Large comes from the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Eureka Springs, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF has proudly served as your source for NPR programming for the past 26 years. You can listen online at our website, KUAF.com. I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF, another new edition of Ozarks tomorrow at noon. Have a great Monday.